Tony Stark.
Tony, something's happened here.
I'll see you in a few hours.
Iron Man, command system on.
He's a biological combat terrorist. I'm just a man in an iron suit.
There's no reason this has to be difficult.
Yes, there is.
Welcome to the Marvel Superheroes Podcast. I'm Diablo Frank, and with me is...
Illegal Machine.
And... Mr. Fix-It.
And I'm not sure what we're doing for sure, because you have a much bigger stack of comic books than I was expecting, but I know at minimum
That's
we're going to talk about Iron Man's Extremis.
Yeah, we're going to talk about... when did this come out? Oh, gee, look, man, I'm so unprepared. What is this, 05? 05, 06, six-issue story arc, Warren Ellis and Adi Granov that inspired sort of, I guess in some ways, the modern MCU. You take on Iron Man a little bit, but then mostly Iron Man 3, which was the Extremis storyline.
Well, what I will mention, what I remember is that they canceled the original volume of Iron Man because I think that they'd done the Heroes Reborn and the Heroes Return. I think at some point they'd done the legacy numbering, and then they canceled that run and they started a new Iron Man run. And this was supposed to be the beginning of that run, and the book was so late that they started a whole other Iron Man series, if I remember correctly, and then they just called this a miniseries retroactively, if I remember correctly. That's how it went.
I mean, we should name these podcasts where like Mac goes down memory lane or some or the re-informing of Mac or something. So this is
reformatted.
The miseducation of a legal machine.
There we go. That's a good one. Except I pay my taxes. So I started with the, if you did listen to our last podcast, I read Christopher.
I'm not 100% certain that they'll be directly one.
The last Marvel Superheroes podcast?
Well, there might be something between when this one comes out and then, yeah, because there is an anniversary coming up.
Just fucking scroll back a couple episodes. Jesus Christ, people.
So we, an Iron Man tab
Will
on the blog.
Fucking stop cutting me off, for Christ's sake. So I picked up Christopher Cantwell's 25 issue run via four or five trades, read those. We did a podcast on it. Go listen to it. I think it turned out okay. So at the end of that episode, Frank and I sort of talked about, well, what should I be reading, right? Like from, I stopped collecting Iron Man in the early 2000s. So what have I missed, right? Because every time I start to look at a couple issues, they're like, hey, this is the one where Iron Man's adopted. And I'm like, man, I don't want to read that. And I put it back on the shelf and go off. So I thought the Cantwell stuff was going to be good. I'm not going to spoil that episode, guys. Go listen to it, although it'll probably pop up in this episode. So then, obviously, this Warren Ellis, Adi Granov stuff, they made a movie out of it, right? So I'm like, well, I should probably pick this up. And in fact, it's only six issues. I guess I didn't realize it was such a short run. When I hear of Warren Ellis's run, to me, six issues isn't a run. This is like a miniseries. This
limited
is
not run. A, limited
right.
series.
So they're limited series that go 12 issues back in my day. Six issues is fucking nothing, right? So, especially with modern word counts. Now, this isn't 2020, which is when the Cantwell stuff came out, which has even further reduced word counts. This is decent. Yeah, I picked this up, and then there was an auction for Iron Man 1 through, I think, 35 or 36, the floppies, which the first six are this.
It's worth noting that the edition you have is apparently like a post-Iron Man movie edition featuring image from the Iron Man movie as the cover, and is also an old library edition that's had the crap kicked out
of
it.
Yeah, I paid $1.99 for this, but then I had to pay to ship it, which sucked because it was very beat to shit. But that's fine because that means I can let my kids do whatever they want with it. So I picked up this. I got two of the Matt Fraction Salvador La Roca omnibuses sitting around here somewhere. I got really good deals on those. And flipping through those look really interesting. Those piqued my interest. But so I found a 1 through 35 floppies for like $30, which is less than a dollar an issue. And I'm like, and it was free shipping. I'm like, all right, I'll pick that up. So I have the first six would be this Warren Ellis run. And then it's the Knopf brothers. I forget these fellows' names. They pick up afterwards, and that runs through. There's like a story after Extremis. Then there's the Civil War tie-in issues. Then it goes to Tony Stark, director of S.H.I.E.L.D. I haven't gotten through all that stuff yet, but that's where I'm at now. So I'm going to read that before I get to the Fraction stuff. But the Fraction stuff, I think, took place before all this. But this is such a fresh... All these runs are such fresh starts. I don't really think the order with which I read them really matters.
And I'll point out, too, I'm confident the Fraction stuff came out around the time of the movie. So that means that run, if it's several years before the movie, therefore Fraction will come out of your director of S.H.I.E.L.D. and all that kind of good stuff.
Are you sure?
We'll check the years, but I believe so, yeah.
I think they're on the... Here, they're right here.
See, I got confused because I thought that Extremis was after Civil War. I didn't realize that it was the series that led into Civil War, but I'm pretty confident this is the series that followed that series. Matt Fraction, Salvador LaRocca stuff.
This is copyrighted 09 and 2010.
Right, and this is 05.
So, yeah, okay. This is 05. Right, okay. So then, yeah. I don't know how many issues post-Civil War this stuff pops up. I don't know. I got to
figure
out.
But it is post-Civil War. So that means that the run that you got was before these editions.
Yeah, so then I think I am reading them in order somehow.
Yeah. And see, Mr. Fixit, you read Extremis...
Except for the Cantwell stuff. Obviously, that was 2020, yeah. 2021.
Now, you read Extremis as it was coming out, right?
Yeah, the floppies back in the day.
And you were a Warren Ellis fan, and that's part of it, right?
Of course.
Did Adi Granov do anything before that, or was that his big thing? That's like what launched him, right?
I believe so, yeah.
What did you think about the book as it was coming out?
I remember thinking it was digital art for the longest time when I first saw it. The story itself, I mean, I remember enjoying it because it's Warren Ellis, so it's going to be fucked up in some way, and it's going to be, you know, the heroes are going to come off kind of scummy. That's just the way Warren Ellis rolls. But I remember liking it. I mean, I remember going from this straight to his, I believe he started writing, Dark Avengers and all that shit, too, and I kind
of... Dark Avengers would have been part of Civil War, yeah. If I recall correctly. I think that was part of the fallout from Civil War.
Yeah.
Because
he had Iron Patriot and all that stuff, yeah.
And you were still going to comic shops back then, too, yeah, right?
I believe so.
Was Fryhole reading any of that stuff with you, or anybody you were talking to at the comic shops about the stuff, how people were reacting to it?
Actually, no. You know what? I think I kind of stopped going to the shops. I was doing the trades now. I was waiting for the trades. I wasn't buying the floppies as much, and I believe Fryhole would buy the stuff, and I would read his stuff. That was the symbiotic relationship we had for that.
I did read Extremis, and I think that I read your trade paperback collection, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, anytime trades come up, I would pick them up, but I wouldn't go out looking for them. And I usually try to get a good deal on them. So, but I remember thinking that, I liked Extremis. I kind of flipped through it again, and I vaguely remember stuff of it. Now, the second movie's based off of it, right?
Third.
Was it the third? Oh, that's right. With Pepper Potts turning into an extremist.
I was curious about it, mostly because I knew Mac liked Iron Man, and I'd always tried to read some Iron Man stuff just so that I have a better sense of why he liked the character. And also, I think you had the trade, and, you know, it was Warren Ellis, had a nice artwork. It was a short run. So I figured, why not? I think you might have recommended it to me, too. It got in my hands somewhere. I wasn't, like, going out of my way to get a hold of it, so I think you put it in my hands. And I remember reading it, and, you know, I'm hot and cold with Warren Ellis. I think that he's a writer who I know is capable of doing good work, but he also has a tendency to sometimes cash the checks, and he's got certain tropes that he goes back to over and over again. But he also is a tech guy. He's a futurist. He's one of these guys who read the magazines and took advantage of the new developments and stuff. So I was interested. I wanted to check it out. So reading it, I was not into... I don't like nanites. I think that that's... I know that it feels like a cheat, because again, it's one of those things like Stan Lee with Radioactivity in the 1960s where it just magically does whatever the hell the writer wants it to do.
Yeah.
And we've talked about the movies enough times where I've stated how much I hate the nanites being in the movies and him just magically having armor materialize, and of course all the Marvel movies with their stupid mask on, mask off stuff. So irritating. The story I thought was okay. It was surprisingly more violent than I was expecting, especially upon rereading it. It's like, wow, he clearly had gotten inspired by like 28 Days Later and the zombie renaissance with the way the extremist was handled in this story. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten that his extremist people also breathe fire, which another one of those things where like, oh God, it's a little bit easier to take the way the nanites are in this story because you could see where they reduce like some energy projection or heat generation or stuff like that. So it didn't seem as ridiculous as when they did it in the Iron Man 3, but I still wasn't a huge fan of the power set, the ability of the human being to like rebuild themselves and punch holes in Iron Man and stuff. It felt like a lot of it was just like, let's show how vulnerable Iron Man could be. And I'm not sure that a horror take really works for Iron Man. I don't think that's a character that really plays well in horror. But at the same time, it's super duper clear how much the visuals that Adi Granov did for the book influenced how the Marvel Universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe came about. Mm-hmm. My understanding is one of the ways that they sold the movie to investors or stakeholders or whatever was showing them an image of Adi Granov's Iron Man going, this is what it'll look like on the screen. And very clearly, that is what got on the screen for the most part. I think the movie improved upon it by going a little bit further back for designs. I don't like the mask design in the miniseries, but obviously it looks like this is what it could look like in live action. They pulled that off, and I think that really helped to sell Iron Man as a concept. And again, even when they were talking about making an Iron Man movie, I always felt like that was something that could translate extremely well to the screen, where like I'm a Captain America guy, and I was always terrified about them trying to get Cap right and blowing it because of how difficult it was to take the character from the page onto the screen. Iron Man seemed like much more of a natural progression to me, and I think that graphic novel really proved it, about how good it could look in live action.
Okay, so 6 issues. Do we need to recap story at all?
Yeah, it's not a detailed story. I just read it, so right. If you don't feel comfortable, I'll knock it out real quick.
I would like your assistance. So again, fresh start for Iron Man. It opens, just to give you the gist of what's going on in it. He gets interviewed by a dude doing a documentary, and Tony sits down with him. He's like, "Oh yeah, cool man. Yeah, you know, you're a famous
one of those gotcha artists. And boy, does he have 70s hair. So it's weird because there were elements of the painting style that also kind of reinforce that 70s-ness. So it's weird how it's supposed to be very modern, but also it feels a little dated at the same time, or a little vintage, I guess you could say.
I'm sorry, Mr. Pillinger, yes? John Pillinger. Thank you for this time. Not at all. I'm an admirer of your documentaries, Mr. Pillinger. Shall we get started?
You're very kind. Gary, you want to get set up?
If you're sitting there and Mr. Stark is behind his desk, I'm cool.
What's the name of this film again, Mr. Pillinger?
Ghosts of the 20th Century.
Okay.
Okay. Gary.
Speed.
In your own time, John.
I'm here at the Coney Island offices of Stark International with the company's founder, CEO, and head technologist, Anthony Stark.
Tony's fine.
Tony, would it be fair to define you as an arms dealer?
I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't deny that we've made...
But you do design and sell arms.
I wouldn't deny that we've designed arms for the U.S. military, of course.
In fact, Stark International was founded on weaponeering, I believe.
My first major contract was for the U.S. Air Force, yes.
What was that contract?
My initial engineering interest was in miniaturization. The USAF saw applications in munitions.
That was the seed pod bomb, yes?
It was. The same process, however, led to innovations
in... The seed pod was first used in Gulf War I? How old were you?
I was maybe 19. I forget.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the seed pod dispensed hundreds of smart micro-munitions from a mother bomb casing, yes?
Yes, it was intended to destroy airfields and cripple armored convoys.
Did they all work?
Excuse me?
Did all of those little bomblets go off as anticipated?
You'd have to ask the military. We never got an operations report on every single micro-munition. There were tens of thousands.
Perhaps you'd like to look at these pictures. Each one of your bomblets has the explosive force of 3 sticks of dynamite. 18% of them suffered timer failures. They're scattered across the theater of conflict. Children find them, Tony. Can you tell us what the Stark Sentinel is?
It's a landmine.
Again, designed when you were in your early 20s.
Yes. Many of them form a defensive line between North and South Korea.
You're unaware of Stark landmines in, say, East Timor?
Yes.
Reportedly, you yourself were injured by one of your own landmines.
Yes. I'd been asked to look at ways to contain Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. I went out there to consult. There was a skirmish with Taliban gunmen. I'm fine now, thanks.
Was that before or after you sold the super gun to a Gulf state?
I'm afraid that's classified information.
But you did design a gun with a half-mile-long barrel intended to lob tactical nuclear devices some 400 miles.
I would like to be able to comment, but I'm under restrictions on that subject.
I see. How many of these devices led you to the design of the Iron Man suit?
I think everything was leading me towards the Iron Man.
Is it a military device?
I don't think so.
But in keeping with your other inventions, it certainly has military applications.
Everything has military applications. All tools have a destructive potential.
And the Iron Man suit certainly possesses awesome destructive potential, doesn't it? I mean, I don't see a benign side to your patented repulsor technology.
Actually, the repulsor has application to cheap non-chemical space launch.
I see. Are you developing that?
Not at this time.
I see. I believe the unknown test pilot of the Iron Man suit is, in fact, tasked solely as your personal bodyguard.
That's a little disingenuous of you, John. You are well aware that I donate Iron Man's services to special response groups like the Avengers all the time.
Sure. My point is that other than guarding you and performing peacekeeping operations, well, the Iron Man suit isn't used for anything else. Therefore, really, it's just a defense industry application, right?
All technologies have that kind of application. My point, and I don't want to talk over you, John, but you've run me over whenever I've tried to expand on an answer. My point, John, is that Stark microelectronic breakthroughs have all led to useful social technologies through that initial military funding. No, I didn't first think to myself that taking microchips down to the nanometer limit would be good for bombs. And the money from Seed Pod was driven into medical biometric implants, cardiac replacement medicine, and internal analgesic pumps. Am I an arms dealer? No. Did I start out as a weapons designer? Yes. Do I intend to die as one? No.
Do you think they have your pain-killing drug pumps in Iraq? Do you think an Afghan kid with his arms blown off by a landmine is remotely impressed by an Iron Man suit?
I never claimed to be perfect. I always knew there would be blood on my hands. I'm trying to improve the world.
Improve the world? Thanks for your time. I'm curious, actually. If you know my work, why did you agree to this interview?
Me first. Why am I a ghost of the 20th century?
Because your arms work of the 90s still haunts the poverty and war-stricken countries they were deployed in.
I wanted to meet you. You've been making your investigative films for, what, 20 years now? I wanted to ask, have you changed anything? You've been uncovering disturbing things all over the world for 20 years now. Have you changed anything? You've worked very hard. Most people have no idea of the kind of work you've done. Intellectuals, critics, and activists follow your films closely, but culturally, you're almost invisible, Mr. Pillinger. Have you changed anything?
I don't know.
Me neither. It's been an honor to meet you, Mr. Pillinger.
Yes. Thank you for your time, Mr. Stark.
Anyway, so you can see he's leading him down this thing. I think it ends with like mines blowing off kids' limbs or something like that. He's just going hard on him, right? So that's kind of how they're setting Tony Stark up.
We're getting Cantwell flashback.
We're gonna get to that.
Okay. But I did like that.
I don't want to.
I liked at the end. Tony points out I knew what this was when I walked into it. I also know that none of these gotcha interviews you've done have actually done anything good for anybody. They haven't seemed to cause any repercussions. Posing's great, but only people like me and educated people bother to watch your documentaries. Meanwhile, you want to ask me about things that I've changed? You want to ask about the positive changes that my technology have afforded the world? So it was a nice little twist where it's like, I know who you were, I know what you were doing, but I got a message for you as well.
Yeah, he's been an honor to meet you, Mr. Pillinger. He's like, yes, thank you, Mr. Stark. And that's how the scene ends. You kind of get a vibe for how Tony is in this series just from this conversation. I don't want to contrast it to the Cantwell stuff yet. We'll get there. We all know what Extremis is. Extremis in this book is exactly the same as Extremis in Iron Man 3, except what is dude's
name? There's metals that are inside the nanites, or that the nanites bring in there with them, and there's also like vital fluids and stuff. So you're able to like manifest a shell around yourself, which will occur later on in the book.
Right. Except in Iron Man 3, Killian is like the main antagonist in the whole film. In this one, Killian is a scientist who, in the very, very first pages of the trade, is writing sort of like a, not a manifesto, but sort of explaining what happened.
A confession,
right? That's the word I was looking for. And then he blows his brains out. So right there, I was like, oh man, who's this guy who killed himself? And then what is homegirl's name in this? She's the same
Maya
name.
Right,
yeah, Maya. She was her name in Iron Man 3 too, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, I think they took the names directly from the book. Obviously Extremis was a big influence on the movie,
right?
And again, they both meet at a seminar. I mean, they don't ever say that they slept together. It seemed like they were maybe friends that also attended some college stuff together, because they have one of their professors who's basically the Michael Caine character from Children of Men showing up later on in the story. Their relationship was a little ambiguous. I don't know if they ever had any romantic elements though.
Maya Hansen, I think is her name. Yeah, so anyway, she storms out of the office and she goes, Dr. Killian shot himself. And I was like, oh shit, that was Killian? That's it? Like I thought he was going to be like this. I thought he was going to be the extremist dude throughout this book. And I'm like, oh no, he shot himself in the first three pages. That's weird that he's like the main villain. I just assumed he was was part of Iron Man's rogues gallery now. And it was just funny to watch him blow his brains out.
Iron Man 3 was the girl's the villain. And then like Perlmutter is like, we can't sell girl action figures, we need a boy. And that's probably how you end up with Killian.
Well, they didn't sell any Killian action figures either.
True.
So the guy who actually takes Extremis. So Extremis has now been linked to some domestic terrorist organization. Dude yokes up on this stuff.
I have to point out that the guy's name is Malin. And by this point in time, the artist John Malin was already in the comic book industry. John Malin is also at the forefront of the alt-right comic skater movement. He's one of the main voices of that movement. And of course, this character in this story is basically a neo-Nazi who's anti-government and stuff. I have to wonder if maybe there was some critical commentary from Ellis with regard to the naming of this character.
Burn.
I didn't know about any of that, but that's interesting. Maya Hansen calls Tony, since she knows Tony, to help her get to the bottom and figure out where the Extremis dude is. Terrorize. He starts out in Houston, funny enough.
And what's
the home base for the Rolled Spy podcast.
The actual base for the technological firm that's developing Extremis is in Bastrop. We've actually, well, I don't think we have. I've gone to the Cult Classic Film Festival in Bastrop, and I think that's where the gas station from Texas Chainsaw Massacre is supposed to be, but I haven't been over there yet. So it's just weird for me. Like, it's 2 hours outside of Houston. It's like, you know, I'm very familiar with this particular track. I'm a little sorry they didn't have any visual references to make it clear that this is Bastrop, this is Houston. There were a lot of city stuff in Bastrop that I'm not familiar with, so I do kind of think that maybe that's figment of the imagination. But yeah, it is cool to get a little hometown recognition in this Iron Man story. Not expected. I did not remember that at all.
Yeah, well, yeah, and obviously I didn't have any clue. Yeah, the flashback for this guy's life is that he, is it Mal? I thought it was Malin. What did you say his name was?
I just pronounced it Malin, but I guess the spelling is, I believe, the same.
I guess in my head I've been calling it Malin, so I didn't.
And I am John Malin.
Yeah, so they have his little origin
story. I'll be honest, I don't know how you pronounce the artist's name either, so right. It could be either way. Malin, you
stupid. His origin story is that basically he was a kid at like Ruby Ridge. So the government killed his parents, killed his family. So he's full on, as you described him, a white nationalist freak show, right?
Well, at one point he runs into a goth girl that's a liberal and antisocial. And when she gets into a good argument with him, he punches her head off.
Yeah, he kills her. So Iron Man's first big throwdown, Malin just absolutely trashes him, including like almost punching through his armor and killing him, right?
Yeah, that kick where he took out Iron Man's knee, that I felt that one.
Yeah, it's nasty. Tony has the idea, the only way we're going to beat this dude, he's basically saying he can't think fast enough to move the armor to keep up with this dude because he's moving at such ridiculous speeds. So his plan is that, first of all, I'm dying for my injuries. One. Two, the only way I'm going to be able to stop this guy is if I have his power. So he convinces Maya to inject him with Extremis, with him making modifications. He basically this was in the movies too, the little like circle magnet things in his body that he can use to attract the armor. That appears, I don't ever remember that from any other Iron Man comic. That's literally here, where the little sensors are embedded in his skin so the armor can fly to him.
It's not just a sensor, though. That's a port, because the little flakes of metal. Look,
dude, I don't fucking know. This is all technobabble. Sure. Don't correct me on the technobabble.
I'm just saying that those ports allow for the metals that are being transported by the nanites to cover him, and that's how he gets the sheath that connects to the armor so that he can, at a nerve level, run the suit and command the suit.
Yeah. So from there...
And it also allows him to not have to carry such a heavy armor around with him in trunks and
suitcases.
He can actually fit most of the so instead of a shipping container, he can put most of the stuff that doesn't come out of his body will fit into a suitcase again.
Yeah, and he has a moment earlier in the comics where he's sort of like, man, it's crazy to think I used to be able to fit this in a suitcase. He's having to like BS that he has a cars that he's having transported, so he has to call his assistant, hey, ship my car from the warehouse. And really, it's the Iron Man armor they're having shipped around everywhere, which I thought was kind of, it was pretty funny.
And it's weird for me too that I'm struggling with, he still has a secret identity at this point.
Right.
You know, it's just like, what? He's having to tell people are still buying this bullshit, you know?
He's able to go back to the suitcase with the Extremis in his body, because that's what he ends up using at some point. Tony takes the Extremis, and Extremis will, like, cocoon your body as it, like, dissolves your organs and then rebuilds them and stuff. So he has time while he's in this cocoon to run through an origin story. And this is where I think they bring the origin story to, it's the Middle East now, right? Or am I getting my...
Yeah. They still keep Jensen Asian, and they met at a conference. It's not that he's meeting this person for the first time in the Vietnam War. So yeah, there's definitely an updating that plays into the movie later on.
Terrorizers. Now it's terrorizers, which again, like you said, is what.
And there's a lot of Bush administration talk in this particular volume too. Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, Tony goes and he whips this dude's ass with his new Extremis powered armor, and then
he ultimately blasts a hole through the guy using the Unibeam from the chest, which occurs in either the actual Iron Man 3 or one of the deleted scenes. I can't recall, but that does happen in the actual movie. Yeah. It's not the final confrontation. It's one of the lackeys that gets took that way and doesn't stay took.
That's not how he beats him though. He beats him by putting his hands around his head and then firing repulsors between his hands and blowing his brains out.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But yes, before that, there's a pretty cool shot where he's shooting the Unibeam through the dude. Very Warren Ellis-y.
Well, and again, the lack of the double tap costs him in the actual movie.
Right. And then it turns out that Maya Hansen had actually was also part of the selling of the Extremis secrets to the extremists, Sorry, getting extremists and extremists mixed up. And it's because basically all their government contracts had dried up and they were bleeding money. So
they needed to prove that the extremists worked.
Right.
And Tony figured it out because, like a nuclear bomb, you needed two sets of keys to open up the port to get to the extremists. And with Killian dead, Tony had to flip the switch, but Killian obviously couldn't do it on his own because somebody else would have had to have helped him. So that's how that gets figured out. So you're the Iron Man guy. One of the things that bugged me about the story was that I think there are certain essential things you have to keep with characters. I think when you turn Tony Stark into a cyborg, you cross a line for me. I kind of get it because you want to make sure that Tony Stark is the Iron Man. You don't want it to be one of these situations like with the Green Lanterns where there's 15 other guys who can do the same job you're doing and everybody's arguing about who's doing it best. Tony's the inventor. Tony came up with all this stuff. But also there's that one point where he actually looks her dead in the eyes and says, "You're always smarter than me anyway." And then he's using her extremist powers. So at that point, you're kind of compromising
Iron
Man.
Although he reprogrammed.
He did reprogram, but he improved upon it. And I guess, you know, that's the nature of technology, but he still didn't invent it. And so that means he'd be reliant upon this power upgrade from somebody else, which to my mind diminishes Tony Stark as opposed to elevating him. But I can also see where that the added power and the nanite infusion would make him a step above a bunch of the other fake-ass Iron Mans that have sprung up over the years, because it's one of those deals, right. The fire person, the ice person, where every team had to have an armored guy. So it gives him an opportunity to kind of level up above them.
That's the context where it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
Because at this point, Rhodey's out there. There's so many Iron Men out there that I think it does.
By this point, Marvel owns Prototype as a for instance for Malibu.
Oh, there you go.
So Spitfire and the Troubleshooters, you know, all those guys.
And the way he beats the guy, he could have just repulsored the dude's brains out to begin. You could have done that without injecting yourself with all this stuff. Here's why I probably didn't hate it as much as I probably would have in 2005, 2006, whatever. Having read the Christopher Cantwell story that obviously steals this entire, he just stole the Extremis story and stretched into 25 fucking issues where he gets the power cosmic, where he's dying. There's even talk in these issues about the anesthesia.
He's got painkillers built into his armor. So when his hand is fractured and in ribbons and his knees taken out and he's got internal injuries, he's like, yeah, but I can kill think strength because I'm not keeled over in agony because I've got painkillers in my suit. Yeah.
The first thing Cantwell does is get Tony's body trashed so that he can use the painkillers in the suit. Now look, it's the same character. It's the same suit. It's the same painkiller mechanism, but it just seemed kind of weird to me that he jumped painkillers? He could get addicked to them.
It's almost like
I better get super fucked up. Like he got fucked up here. And then how he ends up curing his body is by getting the power cosmic extremis to heal his body and turn him into this otherworldly life form. And it's sort of like, he just went another step. He just took this up exponentially, right? And
it seems like, hey, Christopher Cantwell, this big Spider-Man fan who talks a whole bunch about how much he loves Spider-Man, read a little bit of material, obvious source material, to inform his work on Tony Stark, where he writes him as though he's Peter Parker, essentially. And he's the guy who's constantly getting kicked while he's down.
He read Armor Wars 1, maybe Armor Wars 2, and Warren Ellis' 6-issue run. I think that's all he read and made an entire book. I mean, then he had Spider-Man villains pop up, like Stiltman. Yeah. What I was kind of shocked with when I read this was that this is such a thin little story. This is like nothing.
That was the other thing, too, is they made such a big deal about it.
Yeah.
When he's coming out, and it's like, this is very small. It's one guy. It's one guy in the extremist. It's two encounters. Tony gets beat the first time. He fixes himself. He beats the guy the second time. Oh, by the way, I know that you were it was you all along. I know it was you. Fingers Maya. And then that's not the way we would usually want Tony to finger Maya, but she goes to jail.
Yeah, I mean, really? I was shocked. Again, I was already shocked to begin with when I found there's only a 6-issue arc to begin with. But then once I got through it, I'm like, it's just one extremist guy? It's not the whole team of goons like in Iron Man 3. There is no real, mastermind baddie. It's Maya.
Is that AIM?
The extremist guy goes into the FBI headquarters in Houston, Texas, kills all the agents he can get his hands on, mutilates anybody else, and then he starts walking to Washington, D.C. after his encounter with Tony because he had his fellow terrorists driving him in the back of a truck. Tony takes them out, and so he's walking the rest of the way. Yeah. And Tony stops before he gets to Washington, D.C., the end.
Yeah, I mean, there's really not a lot to it.
I do wonder, though, again, maybe I'm misremembering. My recollection was this was the launch of a new volume, and I think the assumption is that Warren Ellis would be continuing with that volume. But again, this was plagued by production delays, and I do think they had a whole other creative team kind of pick up with number 7 or whatever they ended up doing. And so he went from him starting a volume to him writing a miniseries. And I'm wondering if maybe the story evolved as a result of that. Maybe he lost interest when he wasn't the guy writing the rest of the series, and he had no interest in skipping his own story to get to number 7, 8, and 9, for instance.
Well, but no, but 7, 8, 9, he's got the extremists. I mean, it picks up from
the Warren Ellis writing it.
I don't know why he only did 6 issues. Maybe it was just a bluff on Marvel's part to convince people like he was going to, hey, we got Warren Ellis, as if he's here for the long haul. He's only signed on for 6 issues. That's all he's doing. And it got so popular, they're like, well, I mean, maybe it was originally going to be a miniseries. And once it got so popular, they're like, well, let's just keep this 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
That's not how I remember it, though. No? I remember it being the launch of a new volume.
Okay. Well, then I think they bluffed people in that Warren Ellis only was going to do 6 and was peacing out.
Mm-hmm. And I think that what happened is he was intending to do a run, and Adi Granov was so slow that Marvel decided they wanted to jump the storyline so they could get a monthly Iron Man book out, and probably pissed off the writer, and he deuced out because they were doing number 7 before he got to number 6. Is important.
So anyway, I was expecting to find a bunch of, like, and again, it maybe it's the Cantwell stuff that tampered it. Like, I didn't have any real problem with Tony here. Tony, look, he looks bad because he sells arms, and people are calling him out in this.
But well, now he'd already stopped doing that in the old series, right? Or did he restart being a weapons?
No, he stopped. Yeah, but he also didn't get. Get shrapnel in his heart in Iraq either. So
right, I don't know what right. So this is a kind of a soft reboot, basically.
I think that's what it was. But you know, I don't know what. I didn't read the issue that immediately predated this number one, so I don't know where he was at that point. So I didn't really have any problems with Tony in this. I was expecting to like hate this because I had heard, oh, you don't want to read Warren Ellis's take on Tony. But again, the Cantwell stuff is so like putrid, and he's such a bitch that like he actually has like confidence in this book and solving problems.
He's got the sarcasm there. He's willing to confront people who would question his motives and his gains, and be confident that I've ultimately done what I think is the right thing to do and stand up for himself. So yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not going to say I loved this, but it was pretty. I mean, the Adi Granov stuff, it's not like always great. There's some issues. Anything with the Iron Man armor looks amazing. A lot of his humans are not, but
I tend to agree with Fixit. His stuff really looks like it's digital. I think everything has a sort of plastic quality to it. Even the armor looks like shiny plastic a lot of the time. And I went ahead. I didn't think I was going to, because I didn't know if we were going to record on it tonight, and you had it around. So I had the opportunity while you guys were watching the sports ball to read through the trade paperback. And I could see a strong John Bolton influence. I could see a strong Christopher Muller influence, especially with the extremist stuff. Anytime he wanted to do something horror or something visceral, he switched into Muller mode. And it's like, wow, that's not the same guy who's drawing that John Bolton-y looking stuff. And I was thinking there was somebody else. Oh, I thought he looked a little bit like Ariel Olivetti when he does
his
painting.
Ariel Olivetti is who I was going to say.
Yeah, and so it's a little plastic, and like you said, it's not really consistent. I think it ultimately is pretty, and especially the covers are great. The armor looks great. He's not Alex Ross, you know. I'm not being blown away by it like I would some of the other painters. Any of the guys I just named, I'd rather be the painter than the person who did it, but I think he does a nice enough job, but it does look a little digital and a little plastic to me. And there's a lot of people and rooms, and the background is just sort of a vague color.
Wall. It's like it's a gradient on a wall. But I will say, so what did you think of his Tony Stark?
I thought he handled him fairly well.
Can you tell who he looks like?
Who does he look like?
He looks like Tom Cruise.
Oh, does he?
In the early issues. But you want to know who he looks Tom Cruise mixed with? Adi Granov.
Oh, is that what Adi Granov looks like?
I think Tony looks like a mix of Tom Cruise and Adi Granov in this book. Hold on, let me.
I don't like the goatee. I think the mustache around the mouth is a little too thin.
Like, shit, I had it right here. That's Tom Cruise.
I can see that.
That's Tom Cruise
that.
Mixed with a little bit. Let me find a picture of my old boy Adi Granov.
Look a little like Skeet Ulrich there too.
I'm Googling Adi Granov, folks. Adi Granov, by the way, have we talked about on the podcast before, is jacked. Didn't used to be. He became like a fitness freak that kind of sounds bad. Good for the guy getting in shape, but the dude is like freaking jacked. And now he works with Tool. He does all the Tool's like tour posters.
I couldn't remember. I knew he did something, but I can kind of see it. Well, keeping that, that's probably a more modern picture. These books are almost 20 years old.
Right.
So he probably looked a little smoother back then.
Unfortunately, when you Google his name, you get his art, right? So it's kind of hard to get Adi Granov, his face. I mean, it's kind of hard to get more pictures of the guy here. Maybe, right? You see his cheekbones? God, dude, I can't really.
No, I agree with you.
The cheekbones and beard.
I mean, most artists look like their art anyway.
Yeah.
It's always weird when they don't look like their art, in fact.
Yeah, but that usually works more like when it's like, I created a character. The character kind of looks like the guy who created him instead of like Tony Stark. He's like painting himself. But he does like, and also like, this is the same panel. He totally copied this panel, right? Like, that's that shortcut stuff.
Right,
That's the same panel. But yeah, I thought it was funny he looked like Tom Cruise because Tom Cruise had been trying to get an Iron Man movie off the ground in the late 90s, early 2000s. So it's kind of, and then the fact that they use this to then go pitch a movie that had nothing to do with Tom Cruise kind of correctly. That Tom Cruise in a way kind of still made the movie even though he didn't do it.
Right. I will say that I'm glad that the photo reference isn't too overt though.
It's only the occasional panel where you're like, oh, you're doing the Leonardo DiCaprio meme where you recognize it.
Right.
But yeah, it's not that. And again, it's only because I follow Adi Granov on social media, so I know what the dude kind of looks like.
Right.
But yeah, so I'll say that.
Mr. Madeline. Lay on the ground, hands behind your head, ankles crossed, or I'm going to have to kill you.
Then you're gonna have to kill me. Because I've been given a tool to save people like me from those criminals in the White House. And you're an idiot if you think I'm not gonna use it.
You know why you frightened me? Why I had to deal with you myself? I made the first version of this suit to save myself and a friend from criminals with guns. I must have killed 50 people trying to free us. And my friend still died. A stray bullet went through the side of the hut, killed him instantly.
My folks died the same way.
And you killed 50 people you never met 20 years later. You're my nightmare, the version of me that couldn't see the future. Some murder-happy hillbilly who never in his life had a thought about what these tools are for.
Shut up. Shut up. Die. Die. Die.
In Iron Man 3's defense, I bet if for them hear me say those fucking words, this is so thin, this is hard to make into a 2.5 hour movie.
No, you would need more material.
You need more material, yeah. And I think maybe that's part of...
Not enough padding.
This is
and a lot of what
this
was
is a side mission MCU movie. Yeah. So unfortunately, I think how thin this is might have contributed to why they had to ad-lib so much in Iron Man 3.
Well, the entire Mandarin story is a for instance.
Oh, god damn it, I forgot about the Iron Man. You know what? And to tee off on the Mandarin story, as I'm watching What If, and one of the What Ifs in season 2 talk about what if Hela had the rings of the Mandarin. I'm like, oh, fucking cool. And as soon as it started, it was the dumb wrist rings. I was like, ah, shit. I'd completely repressed the dumb wrist rings.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, and I repressed Mandarin from Iron Man 3, and it got me again.
And you want to be my successor to the MCU.
Unbelievable.
God, fucking
unbelievable.
Damn it.
So that's what pisses me off about What If. And I'm not trying to talk about What If here, but this is what pisses me off about What If. This is your opportunity to use Iron Man as much as you fucking want.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard from people about this. People do not like the cartoon Iron Man because the voice isn't close enough to Robert Downey Jr. And everybody can tell they didn't get a good job through the voice.
So the girl who does Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow is like, for a second, you're like, Was that Peggy Carter,
the actress?
Yes. Yeah.
Because
Kate Blanchett did Hela. They got like Sebastian Stan does the three Winter Soldier lines. Like they got every Sam Jackson. They got everybody. The dude who does Tony, he's doing a Robert Downey Jr. impression, kind of.
Yeah.
But what's worse is the Tony Stark character design looks horrible. Mm. He's got this giant forehead and like these really squinty eyes. He looks like Max Headroom or something. Like, it looks really bad. But my point is that why isn't it what if Iron Man took the Extremis? I want to see that.
The What If is all based off the movies. It's not off the comics.
They put Extremis in the fucking movies. That's why it would be a What If, because he didn't take Extremis in the movies. You could do a What If Tony Stark. Tee off the Iron Man Captain America movies we're not going to get anymore. Don't tee off a fucking Nebula. I don't give a fuck if Nebula joined the
Nova Corps.
Fucking cares if Nebula joined the Nova Corps. You can get Karen Gillian to be in a million other Marvel movies. I don't need to see an animated version of that. Give me my Iron Man and Captain America. Hemsworth doing Thor in this fucking series. And you can't give me some knockoff Iron Man Captain America shit. Instead, I'm watching some Native American chick to Kahuta or whatever they created. So you're creating characters for What If. You're creating characters. Give me this shit, you fucking assholes.
Oh, no, trust me. I wish they would do Inferno and
why isn't it a Danny Moonstar? Why isn't it Warbird or Thunderbird or Warpath or any of the actual existing characters that people have already invested in? You're trying to make us care about brand new characters you're creating just for the cartoons. Why did you bother to buy a fucking universe of characters if you're going to just create new characters for your fucking cartoons?
I don't understand.
Did Morph take off when I wasn't paying attention? You know, where are these cartoon original characters that have fucking taken the world by storm at Marvel? I know who Harley Quinn is. I'm familiar with Harley Quinn. The Marvel version of that, where is that? Where does that exist? I've not seen that. Why would you need that? Marvel's already got 5 versions of every fucking popular character anyway. Take one of those.
But people are craving Iron Man.
Yeah.
Because now they're getting Iron Man withdrawals, and you've got a show called What If, which is where you can do this shit to dip back into your universe and change little things. And so far, I've watched 6 of the 8 episodes. The 2 best episodes are the ones with Iron Man in it. And I'm like, these are the only ones I'm enjoying. I don't understand. And then you go to
towards
Tesseract.
The end they're gonna do the thing where they all team up all the What If people again.
Yeah.
No, fuck that shit.
I would like to see what if Tony Stark never gets hurt and takes the path of like becoming a war machine.
Yeah, what if Tony Stark was corrupted by the Infinity Gauntlet? These are the things we need to be fucking doing here. Not Captain Carter, who you created. needed in What If, you're doing a what if of a what if in this scene. As soon as there's a whole episode dedicated to Captain Carter and the Nazi stomper or whatever, where the fuck, or the Hydra stomper.
Which I liked.
Who fucking, I don't fucking care.
I like that episode actually.
About Captain Carter. It was fine. No, it was fine. And in fact, of the eight, that was the, or of the six I've watched, that was the most well animated.
The Red Room and stuff.
The animation of it was off the chain in that. But that, I cared more about that than the actual show itself. But I'm like, get the big three. Get Captain, Iron Man, and Thor together and put them on a what if journey in Sakaar or something. Do that. That's what I was hoping to see from What If. And it, like when they did Marvel Zombies, I'm like, okay, that's something from the comics. And you're able to what if the MCU into the zombie episode. It wasn't my favorite What If episode, but I was like anxious to see it because it was something from the comics. And instead, again, I don't give a fuck about Nebula joining the Nova. Who fucking cares about this shit? I don't know what these people are thinking making these things. Anyway, so anyway, as soon as I was reading Extremis and then I'm watching What If, I'm thinking to myself like, oh, that could be a what if. Since he actually gave himself Extremis in the comics, that's the perfect what if. That's your alternate Iron Man 3. What if he got the Extremis in Iron Man 3? And they could easily do that, and instead they're putting Nebula in the Nova Corps. And it blows my mind. Anyway, sorry.
I would have used the renewed funding to get out of the arms race. Set up on my own. Medical technology. More than 50 people die in car accidents every day. The only mistake I made was giving a damn about who was inside the Iron Man suit. There's no difference between us, Tony. You're no better than me.
But I'm trying to be. And I'm going to be able to look at myself in the mirror tomorrow morning.
I don't know. I think my expectations for the Cantwell stuff were like high. Not high. No, they weren't high because I had them tempered before I actually started reading the book. My expectations were kind of low for this, and also because I hate Iron Man 3.
This is definitely better than Iron Man 3.
Yeah. This is way better than Iron Man 3. And also, like, it really doesn't even need to be six issues. This is like a four issue series.
Right.
A lot of the fight scenes go on for pages and pages with no words. So
there's also a lot of multi-panel dialogue sequences too.
Yeah. That if you just add more words to a bubble, that's two pages could have been one page, right? And, yep. And the fight scenes could be two pages instead of four or five pages. They could have easily knocked this out in 4 to 5 issues, not even six. So there's not, I was just shocked by how little is here. And it sounds like a negative. It's not a negative, but I was curious at the end of the story, like, okay, so they don't like cure him of Extremis. Like at the end of the Cantwell stuff, he renounces the power cosmic or whatever, right? So I was like, where does this go from here? When does the Extremis go away? Does he still have Extremis? He didn't have Extremis in the Cantwell stuff that takes place 20 years later. Or whatever, or 15 years later. So anyway, I was kind of curious. So I have actually read on. I'm not going to talk about any of that because we'll cover it whenever I
get around.
You got another issue of the Miseducation of Illegal Machine, of Tony Stark or whatever. So anyway, that's what I felt. I thought art's banging. This stuff is like Iron Man never got this kind of stuff. The Khafu stuff, I think is.
It feels like it's informed by this as well.
Definitely, definitely. But I didn't want to say that for sure until I had a chance to really go through this. Mm-hmm. But that was my vibe. The fact that there's Iron Man runs out there with Khafu and Adi Granov. What parallel dimension am I in, dude? I got Kieron Dwyer and stuff.
Yeah,
like
you got
that.
Way better artists in the 20th century than you ever had. When you were
outside of
books.
Like, I mean, Sean Chin was pretty good, but he was like a thing when they got Sean Chin.
Sean Chin was a valiant artist, you know, right. Where Salvador Del Rocco was an X-Men artist. You know, that's a big leap.
Right.
There. Adi Granov, like hardly anybody gets Adi Granov, but you know who else got Adi Granov was Captain America. So 10 years ago.
Is this like a little Tales of Suspense thing?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I see what you're doing
here.
Yeah,
you're doing
here.
So 10 years ago, when I was first thinking about starting a podcast, I was directly influenced by the Fire and Water podcast. I was like, well, what could we do? We would want to do like a Marvel thing. It's like, well, you know, me and Mac, you like Iron Man, I like Captain America. Let's do a Tales of Suspense podcast, right? Didn't work out that way. We've never done anything remotely like a Tales of Suspense podcast. But since you had an Adi Granov miniseries for Iron Man, I figured, well, I've had this trade paperback of Captain America Living Legend on my shelf since it came out in like 2011 or 2013 when they collected or something. I was like, well, let me go ahead and read that. And I didn't get around to it because I didn't think we were going to read today. But again, y'all guys do on the goal-a-thon.
Foosball.
The goal-a-thon, yeah, the throwdown-a-thon. And so I'm like, okay, well, I can maybe get this trade paperback too. Not written by Warren Ellis. This is written by Andy Diggle. And Andy Diggle at one time was going to be a thing. I think he did the Losers series for DC Comics, which eventually got adapted into a movie starring Captain America, Chris Evans, as well as Gamora. And who else was in the Losers? Fix It. Who saw that one? Yeah. Was it Bradley Cooper that was in that one?
No.
It was Morgan, the Jeffrey Dean Morgan, right?
Daddy Winchester.
Yeah, Negan was in that one, right?
Daddy Winchester, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And also Ibis.
Idris Elba was in that one, too?
Yeah.
I've seen parts of it.
Hold on. And hold on. There's one more. Wait, Chris Evans.
Isn't there a black guy besides that Idris Elba?
I've seen the movie like once.
Yeah. So anyway, Andy Eagle was supposed to be a thing. What killed him was he took over Daredevil from, I think, Ed Brubaker and just fucking ran that whole thing into the ground. Like they managed to sustain Daredevil since rebooting it during Marvel Knights, and then Andy Diggle just ruined it, and the volume got canceled after him. And he never really recovered from that. None of his projects really blew up. He was doing some stuff for Avatar there toward the end of his career, and then, of course, Avatar's not around anymore, seemingly, except for years on end, they've been selling their back stock in frickin' Diamond Previews. I don't know how they generate enough money to have multiple pages of
page space.
Full color, yeah. Now, Mr. Fixer, you never read Captain America Living Legend, right? Okay. But you just flipped through it. What did you see? What did you think about what you were seeing in there?
I thought it was the extremist for Captain America.
Yeah, very, pretty much,
very,
right?
Yeah,
he's clearly trying to be.
Yeah, and it very much alien, like he has a xenophobe, like...
No, I think that predates Interstellar, if I remember correctly.
I don't know, it looked like extremist, but for Captain America.
Yeah, once again, you're taking a superhero narrative, you're getting a little bit of origin stuff in there, but mostly it's about our hero confronting, like, body horror.
Yeah, monsters. Like some kind of weird armor creature.
So what's happening in this story is at the end of the war, 1945, a Soviet group is going after a Nazi group, and what it is the intention is to capture a rocket scientist because they know that the next thing is going to be USSR versus USA, and so they want to make sure they've got their own rocket scientists.
Operation Paperclip.
Sure. And just trying to get to the base kills much of this troop, and there's a second in command that's 100% with the Russians, completely on mission. The actual leader is like, you're a piece of shit. Most of our people have died trying to get here. Just stop and let these guys live their lives. And the dude ends up choking out his commanding officer and saying, no, or the commander just died, but his last words were continue the attack. But they're not doing very well. And then Captain America shows up and helps them to get into the bunker. But then one of the Nazis manages to kill the rocket scientist and almost kills the murderous lieutenant. But Captain America saves his life. Then, of course, at some point, Cap goes into the drink, although unless you know who Captain America is, they never explain that in the story. The Russian guy ends up becoming a cosmonaut 20 years later, and they have a successful mission to the moon. But the cosmonaut comes into contact with some dark force in outer space that possesses him, causes to kill all the other cosmonauts, and then he lands in like Siberia, and anybody who comes around, he kills. So they basically decide, fuck it, we're just gonna wall this stuff up and walk away from this shit. It's weird because it's actually weirdly similar to a Rennie Harlan movie that came out within a few years of this comic book.
I was gonna say it sounds like a John Carpenter's Captain America.
Right, there's very much a thing going on there. It's a very thing.
I see helicopters, snow, and aliens.
Exactly. And so all these years later, another mission goes out into space, and they're trying to draw on these dark forces to create energy, taking dark matter from space and convert it to energy. And instead, they get Event Horizon, and like almost everybody gets killed by these tentacle monster Cthulhu-looking things, but they're space people. They also manage to crash in Siberia, probably because they're being guided by that lieutenant guy who's been kept alive by the dark forces. But now it's spawning all of these monsters, very much Japanese animation manga type stuff, where all of a sudden people are just spontaneously becoming gross monsters and killing each other and killing other things. And so Captain America goes to investigate this stuff. He's, of course, familiar from the very beginning. They don't make it clear whether or not he's being called himself on this mission. It doesn't seem like it is, but it just so happens that his adamantium shield is exactly, or not, sorry, not adamantium, the vibranium steel combination shield is just the right metal frequency to be the only thing that can kill all these monsters. So he's the only one who's able to save people, kill monsters. He does eventually get possessed, and they're like, oh no, we've lost Cap. It's all going to go downhill from here. But the cosmonaut dude, who is also the lieutenant in the World War II, he manages to bring Cap back to normal because he wants to get indebted because he's tired of being this monster. Cap eventually manages to kill this guy while a lady scientist and the Russian, like a rogue Russian unit that's breaking away from their commander's orders because all the commanders want to turn this into a weapon that the Russians can use against the world. But they're like, this is too dangerous. We need to stop this thing. So they manage to destroy the thing that was creating the hell spawns, and Cap manages to kill the cosmonaut. And in the very end, they club this asshole who's like the guy who wants them system to weaponize the shit. And the colonel guy that was helping him defects to the U.S. And the last thing is old soldiers never die. They just get transferred. And so Cap, the lady scientist, and the rogue colonel fly back in a helicopter to the United States. The end. It's not great. Adi Granov is not, of course, giving it his all the way that he did with Iron Man.
I would say it does not look as good as Iron Man. It's not as good, yeah.
But in some ways, it's okay because it's a little less plastic, a little less digital. It's a little rougher, and I kind of appreciate that because I'm not as distracted by the rubberiness.
Well, I thought it was weird that he did that same scene or that same image of Wolverine when the Brood took over. And he's on his knees, and he has his arms out, and he's screaming
upward. Oh, is that what he's doing there?
Yeah, I saw that caps, and I'm like, good, that's the exact Wolverine pose. It's on a fucking cover of an X-Men magazine.
Well, I think that doing the David Cronenberg's Iron Man kind of makes sense. That's an interesting approach to Iron Man. I don't think Captain America in John Carpenter's The Thing makes as nearly as much sense. I don't think, even though the Captain America title became a horror title at the very end of its run in the 40s, I just don't think Cap really works all that great in horror stories and alien horror stories. So it's just like, what are you doing? And also the miniseries is called Living Legend, and it's like, that has nothing at all to do with the story. There's only like a way of trying to sell the story. But I mean, it looks all right. I didn't hate it. It was fine. It just, if you
weren't wowed.
It feels like if you know you've got Adi Granov painting your book, you should probably try to make it a next level kind of book. And I don't think Diggle was up to that challenge. I think that's why we don't hear from Andy Diggle anymore.
Man, I would have loved to have seen like Red Skull. I want to see Adi Granov's Red Skull.
Yeah, let go full World War II. And actually, that's what I thought I was getting. I figured, okay, this is going to be like a recap of the origin.
Where are the swastikas? There was a swastika in his Warren Ellis run.
Right.
Where's randomly. The swastika in the Captain America book?
So having read it, I'm like, you guys don't need to read this. You can flip through this, get the gist of it. It's not worth trying to give equal time to Cap and Iron Man.
No need to dissect.
Nah, I'm there. Okay. Permanent Marvelite Maximus followers include Blythe Rydoff, Charlie, Dimpy, Evie Rose McFan, Gavin Rizza, True Believer, Yes, Hal Colbeck, Jairo Santos, G. Gathers, Caitlin Farron, Masked Faces and Secret Bases, Mini Stray, Podcast Promotion, Rimley, Tarsha Katori, and The Tattoo. Keepers of the Favorites Flame include Billet Spy Vinyl, Carcosa Trio, Dr. Ange, Derek W.C., Dr. G. Nerdologist, Gregory Litchfield, JMT Productions, Kailash Jwalamukhi, Ladies of Mischief, Wrestling Fan Page and Gaming, Mark Gray, Maxo, Nick, Ock, and What's What a Geek. Among the Nuff Sayers were Captain Entropy, who wrote, I listen and enjoyed very much, especially the impromptu Funeral Tales segment. Frank, I hope you keep going on Netflix Daredevil through the third season. It's my favorite. Billy Hines wrote, I think Brubaker's first arc on Daredevil has big born-again overtones and is great for it. While it ends with a cliffhanger, it's all you need. The support group story was Bendis' Decalogue, not Brew. I feel like Daredevil has been done so well a few times that there's no new take. Miller, of course, then Miller again. Oh, and Miller. Bendis Malieve felt like good TV Daredevil. I really enjoyed Wade and Company. Not as slap happy as advertised and gets dark. I'd read it all. Nothing since has spoken to me. And yeah, I tried the first trade of that. It just didn't grab me. Sorry. Julia Raoul wrote, my history with Daredevil as a kid in the 90s was his appearance in the 94 animated series of Spider-Man and a few issues of the D.G. Chichester and Scott McDaniel armor suit run. I really got into Daredevil around the time of the 03 Affleck movie, and that got me interested in reading Miller. I remember in the late 80s hitting up my local library for trades of the Frank Miller 80s run, Electro Assassin, I really like the art of the book, and Electro Lives Again. Love the art on that too, by Miller, very DKR. I then read a lot of Nascenti and John Romita Jr. run. I 100% that run. Retweet frantic ones include Ed Moore at Teal Productions and Talk Nerdy to Me. And finally, the Mary Marvel Marching Society. Anthony I. Billy Hines, On My Way to Bluer Skies. Chris Leiden. Eugene R. Hendricks. The Hammer Strikes. Random Geeky Stuff. History of Comics on Film. I Was Joe Was. Julia Raoul. Keith G. Baker. Nick Spence. Petrus Gaspard. Randy Caldwell. Richard Field. Satin Tights, a Wonder Woman podcast. Superbound. And Tony S. Endure and Survive.
The Marvel Superheroes podcast is in no way affiliated with or endorsed by Marvel Entertainment. All characters mentioned and audio clips employed are believed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended against their copyright holders. The views expressed in this podcast are assumed legitimate, truthful, and solely possessed by the speaker.
So chop this out, put this earlier in the podcast. The other thing I was going to say about this Iron Man run, fucking forgot. It's not important, doesn't matter. God damn. Oh, no. I was going to say. Anyway, hey.
Oh, by
welcome
the way,
to the second chapter of my journey through modern Iron Man comics. Yeah. I hope you've enjoyed this little dilly-dally of mine.
Well,
and there will be more here in the future because I got a whole bunch of fucking Iron Man comic books to read.
The other day, I was dealing with a kid, and the kid came in with a Wolverine action figure, one of the like the 8-inchers or whatever, like the ones you get at the grocery store where they're not like heavily articulated. It's just like neck, shoulders,
yeah, they're really
hips.
Shitty.
Yeah. Yep. But it was Wolverine, and he's in the yellow and blue costume. And I decided to engage with the kid because I don't, you know, 10, 20 years ago, seeing Wolverine toys would be like, oh God, here's another one. You know, you just like take it for granted. But we're so far out from the heyday of the X-Men movies and stuff, and specifically the cartoon X-Men. And I engaged the kid and his mom, and it turns out the kid like is really into the 90s cartoon, the old Fox cartoon. Yeah. And so it wasn't enough to have a Wolverine figure. He had to have the blue and yellow. And I don't know when this thing was on sale. I don't know how old this figure was because I don't see classic Wolverine stuff running around, you know, even since the Fox purchase. And it's gone from like, oh God, another Wolverine kid to it's actually novel now. It's like, oh, wow, a Wolverine kid, not a Spider-Man kid or Cap kid or an Iron Man kid. But also, I'm seeing a Wolverine action figure. I ain't seen no damn Shang-Chi. And I know I beat that Shang-Chi drum a lot, but it's like all these new people that they've come up with and all these new movies. And it's not my fault that the audience hasn't embraced those characters. It's not my fault that I'm seeing those characters on t-shirts and Halloween costumes and all this other kind of shit. But it tells me something that you've got a kid. This is like a freaking 8-year-old kid or younger, right? He's reached all the way back to the 90s instead of embracing these new guys. But there's something to that,
but
I think.
Didn't they re...
Yeah, they're re-releasing
them. They haven't yet.
They're going to do X-Men 97
But I'm
on
saying
Disney
the merch
Plus.
Is already leaking out. So this last year, you thought that looked good, or you didn't... I don't know if you thought the figure looked
good. No, the figure didn't look great. What looked cool to me was that kid was freaking, like, legit. Like, he went to some trouble to get that figure.
He called you Bub and was smoking a cigar? Yeah. No, but so Marvel Legends did an X-Men 96 or whatever version of that Wolverine.
They came VHS.
Amazing. Oh, yeah. It is, like, cartoon accurate.
Yeah.
But with the Marvel Legends detail,
I got like
Wolverine.
I got Mystique. I'm going to get Wolverine. Someone's giving me Wolverine. And
I almost bought the Wolverine. Yeah. It looks so good. And it is so...
And it comes with the photo where he's rubbing it.
Yeah. Does it really?
Yeah.
God, love these memes. So yeah, that's rad. And then there was something
else. Oh, the Sinister looks good on that one. Sinister looks good. I'm waiting for the Apocalypse because I collect
everything. So to tee off on that, I remember what I was going to say again because I lost another... Anyway.
All I know is there's one Marvel movie out this year. It's going to have Deadpool and Wolverine in it. And I'm betting it's going to do a lot better than all this other bullshit they've been doing lately. Because people actually give a shit about Deadpool and Wolverine and the X-Universe.
Well, I like what I'm hearing with Dazzler showing up and even the girl from Logan.
She was cool. And that was the thing, too.
X-23 from the comics. Or whatever.
Yeah, she's from the comics. That movie came out in like 2018, so she's probably a teenager now.
Yeah.
You could do that. You could run with X-23. You could run with that now.
But I like the fact that they're kind of... This is the one movie that's like almost a what if. It's like a what if movie. Like, what if the Wolverine... Because again, the whole...
Well, it's a multiverse movie because this is the movie that's going to...
It's what if, goddammit.
Yeah.
Call it what it is.
What if X-23 joined the Nova Corps? Well, in season 3 of What If, we're going
to
find out.
So I'm looking forward to that movie. So yeah.
Well, thankfully, it's the first Marvel movie involving the X-Men continuity from Fox, but it's also kind of the last Fox movie probably that we're going to get. And so you got this interesting hybrid where you got to figure this is going to be the road to Secret Wars.
Stop talking about this shit. The whole reason I'm reading these Iron Man comics, I want to talk about these goddamn fucking movies anymore because I'm having more enjoyment.
Yeah, but I haven't had any stingers on the Marvel superheroes for a while, so it gives me an opportunity to throw a stinger in there.
I'm having more enjoyment reading these issues and talking about comic books than I get from talking about these horrible movies.
Yeah, I'm tired of talking about the movies now too. They suck.
And I hate that I just teed this into fucking talking about What If season 2. Jesus.
Actually,
Christ.
I started reading Inferno, so we'll see how that plays out. I found about the two big trades.
Yeah. We can do the same thing, like, because I'm not reading all the stuff that he's reading. Like, we did an episode recently where he read 2 years worth of the Iron Man run, and I skimmed it for the stuff that was of interest to me, and then I did the miniseries on the back end of that. And so,
can I brag about my guy here? This dude's been around comics so long. His skimming, he remembered more than I did reading every single fucking. Incredible skimmer. He knows exactly what to focus on the issues.
He hit all the sweet spots, man. Only
he
sweet spots.
Absolutely nailed it. So give yourself a little credit for
that. Well, you actually read the 2 years worth of the run, though. So, you know, it's kind of important to actually read the material and know it well. And then I just do my best to support you in that.
He did such a good job supporting me.
So I can do the same thing with you because I read a lot of that Inferno stuff when it first came out. I am not reading it again. I'm not skipping it again.
I'm just reading it.
I want.
It's that point where we were just talking about. We talked about earlier, where I was like, I tried to pick up some new stuff here, and I was completely lost. I didn't understand anything. I was a man out of time. I'm like, oh shit. So I went back to my little universe of, well, I know Inferno and I know Executioner Song and I know these things. So I'm gonna go ahead and reread them with today's mindset and see, do they hold up? So I just started reading old stuff.
Well, and what I was explaining to him is, right now the industry is at a low point, like particularly the main publishers, DC and Marvel. You know, the corporations have gone in there and gutted their editorial departments, all their departments, really. And so you don't have any of the old, you've had a brain drain, and also they're bringing in all these new people, and there's no editors to support them, and there's nobody directing them, so they're just writing whatever the hell they want to, and so they're writing characters completely out of character, and people who are familiar with the character are like, you're not writing the right character, and it's like nobody's happy. Like, the new readers don't seem to be most very happy, the old readers aren't happy, sales aren't very good.
Well, and the movies being in the tank is not good.
Well, the movies haven't really had an impact on sales now.
Yeah, but no, I'm not saying sales. Interest. I'm talking about the interest and relevance for a major corporation to keep this shit even going.
Yeah.
As long as the movies are making a bit and they're getting huge payouts for it, they're like, leave those fuckers alone. When the movies start tanking,
yeah,
suddenly it's like, why are we?
Well, but the reason why the movies are tanking is because instead of looking at tried and true comic book stories and adapting them, and also one of the things I'm very interested in about James Gunn over at DC is he's put together a writer's room again. He's got a bunch of people that know comics and Tom King, and they're all working together.
Shots fired.
To make sure that you've got a more comic accurate, more cohesive universe. Where Marvel, of course, they got the fucking swell head. They fired all their comic book guys. They used to have guys like Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Miller and Joe Quesada. And I'm not saying these are the people that I would have put in those positions, but at least you had people that had familiarity with the stories and the comics and what people like to help guide things. And then they roll those guys out and just sort of have letting movie people do everything. And they are fucking it up. Simple as that. They're not understanding who the characters are. They're not understanding the appeal. They're not recognizing that you've got brands that have multi-generational appeal. And therefore, you've got boomer people who like certain characters. You've got Gen X people that like certain characters. You got Zs and millennials, and figure out which of those characters that have that appeal. And so they're like, well, Ms. Marvel was big in Japan. Let's give her a TV show and then try to have her support a movie that cost $250 million. And apparently she was the best part of that movie from what I hear, but clearly it wasn't enough either. So you need people who actually know the universes. Even if they don't necessarily have to be comic book people. You get Larry Houston, who used to do like the X-Men cartoons and stuff. Well, they know the comics. They know the universe. They can help you with that stuff. A Bruce Timm or a Paul Dini could help you with this kind of stuff. But once you get just whoever, you're going back to the old 80s and 90s shit where the Hollywood people just did whatever the fuck they wanted to with the properties, and they don't know the properties, they don't understand what the appeal is, they're just doing what they think is good, and it's not.
Fucking down. Did anybody ever see the Marvels? Anybody ever
seen it? I haven't seen it yet.
Nope. Even you?
Nope.
I've heard some good stuff. It's just that
I'm waiting for it to pop up on DZ Plus. I'm sure it'll be on there like.
It'll be there no long for 40
I think actually in January.
How is it not there already?
I think it's supposed to be there like in January or February.
I mean, we're almost halfway through January.
At the end of January. I just remember seeing something about it, and I was like, I'll wait for then.
You got to remember too, there were those strikes last year, and so they're probably waiting for like a, we don't have anything to show you right now, let's put Ms. Marvel on or Marvel's on, you know.
Sorry.
If you keep going, I'm just going to put the words over.
A little louder.